Did you tell him how we start?
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Oversharing Show, the best darn show on the internet. We're going to start off today. We have a guest again, but we're going to start with a quote, and then Sharon's going to pull a card, and then we're going to introduce our guest. That's how we do it. So I guess I did tell him, kind of, Sharon, a little inside. I always hit record on the funny times. Last week was even better because Ben was actually talking, and I just let him talk, and then I was like, we're starting the show now. But anyway, today's quote is a I don't know who actually said this, but it was a meme, I think, that Sharon sent to me. It said, knowledge is let me try that again. Take two in action. Knowledge is learning something every day. Wisdom is letting something go every day. Empty your cup.
Anonymous.
There you go. Exactly.
And I'm going to be pulling from the Aleister Crowley Thoth deck here, because we have some symbolism coming up with our guests talking about a lot of symbolic things. And he uses some of his cards in his symbolism breakdown. So I'm going to pull from this deck. And here I go. Oh, look at that. The Hanged Man.
Ooh. I like it. Let's zoom in on you. Oh, yeah. Great card. And it's number 12, which is, you know, we don't even have to talk about 12.
Dude, we started recording at 12:12.
Yeah. That's crazy. And I like this one because it kind of shows like another realm under his head, you know, with the snakes in there. And he's hanging from an ankh, and he's making like a symbol with just his body. You know, it's amazing. It's a lot different than a lot of the other hanged mans that you'd see. And to me, it just really represents looking at the world in a whole other way. Like, you just look at it upside down and you can get a different vantage or a different view of what's really going on. That's one of the main. But it, of course, you know, especially with the major arcana, there's so many things you could say from it. But that's like one of the basic ones that I'd
say. And isn't that what we're doing today? Looking at things from a different perspective, from symbolism, just kind of mixing things up.
Yeah.
Yes. That's interesting. It matches my background here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That I really
I thought so, too, because I was looking at your background.
We're going to zoom in.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
Isn't that fun? Oops. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a very appropriate card. That is that particular tulpa has guided me in many forms of initiation on my path. So, of all the 78 cards you could have pulled, that is quite appropriate. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Isn't that how synchronicities work? And we have a guest today. His name is Gabriel Peters, aka Slick Dissident on YouTube. And yeah, I met him on the Weaving Spiders and, you know, some of the other chats, like Chance's chats and things like that. So we've been wanting to have him on and finally set a time and date. So here he is. Without further ado, I present to you Gabriel Peters. Welcome.
Thank you so much, guys. This is exciting. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. And want to get, because we do this almost every time we have somebody new, we get their, you know, kind of their spiritual journey, how they started out and how they came to the cosmology perhaps that they have today, even if it's a working cosmology, because a lot of us are still kind of like on a working path. But yeah, we'd love to hear about that. But I know we're going to get into a lot of other things. It can go anywhere. We can talk placenta, we can talk other really cool stuff. I definitely want to hear the story about how you and Gordy met in the astral and all that. That I want to hear for sure. So,
all right. Well, I'll do a quick run through on my background. When I was I moved around a lot when I was young, experienced a lot of different cultures. I went through culture shock in a big move when I was a kid. But I also learned that sometimes the most difficult lessons are the most valuable, you know. And so I moved from Indiana down to Charleston, South Carolina, and it was very shocking to be thrown into a culture that was still experiencing a lot of racial tension. And also it is a classical, traditional, historical region of the country. So you're literally walking down the street and you expect to see horse and buggies, you know, the way that those houses are preserved. It's really fascinating. But then there's, you know, just a lot of new mentalities to embrace and adapt to. And so that was a interesting young experience for me. But I've been a martial artist since I was about 8 or 9. I started studying Taekwondo and picking up different martial arts wherever I would move along the way. And then it was in college, I moved back to Indiana, back to my roots where my family is. And that was a huge blessing. And it was in college where I decided to take on massage therapy school because I was studying the way of the samurai at that time. And I had learned a maxim that to have the presumption of doing harm, one must adopt the responsibility of healing. And so I felt that I needed to balance that out because so much of what I had learned was how to, you know, break boards and maim a man in a million different ways, all the, you know, all these things. So yeah, my first day of massage therapy class, I met this amazing goddess who was a dance major at Ball State University. And she took me aside at the end of class and asked me if I had ever heard of capoeira. And I had not. That was in the days when mixed martial arts were on the rise. And like MMA was a big thing where people were amalgamating different styles. And so for her to throw this word at me that I had never heard of, I was, instantly intrigued and drawn in. Plus, she was beautiful. She was so beautiful.
It doesn't hurt.
So she had me at hello, and she invited she invited me to her capoeira class that she was the instructor of. And I went to the class, and it was very difficult. Even as an experienced martial artist, it was difficult because it was a different language. It included music. And so there was a rhythm, which was not my strong suit at that point. I was still learning how to dance and look cool, you know? So the, you know, lesson number one in all martial arts is basically how to get out of the way. It's rule number one in Aikido. It's pretty universal. And so I was learning how to get out of the way and doing a decent job at it. And at the end of class, she pulled me into the game. It's called the hoda, into the circle. And, she essentially did this absolutely beautiful maneuver where she goes into an inversion, a handstand, much like the hanged man, the card you pulled. And then she does the splits while she's inverted, looking me in my eye the whole time, and then proceeds to execute a double helicopter kick to my head. And the whole time she's smiling at me from upside down, and I'm looking at her eyes, but her feet are coming at my head, so I had to get out of the way. And then I stand up and I got to get out of the way again because she keeps turning and her little feet are just spinning in the air. It was such a fascinating maneuver. And then I expected her to come down and hit the ground. And I didn't hear anything. She was like a cat when she landed, and she just proceeded to continue to roll and come back to standing and dance more while staring me in the eyes the whole time. And I kid you not, it was shock and awe like George Bush never dreamed of. It was such shock and awe. It was glorious. And so, yeah, I met the Shekinah in the Hoda of Capoeira, and her name was Anna Peterson. She's a goddess in my heart still to this day. And so that was my initiation on a new level of martial understanding. And in fact, Capoeira is about cultural preservation, is another important lesson that it took me years to grasp what that meant. But that's part of what Capoeira is all about, is preserving culture, preserving the mythology and the songs and the traditions of Afro-Brazilian ritualistic breakdance fighting.
Awesome. And I will interject and say that I remember the story when you talked about it on Topher's podcast. So yeah, if anybody wants to hear more of that, it was really a great, really great story between you, and you guys had a lot in common. It was really cool. So just shouting that one out.
Nice. Yes. So that is still to this day, that's what I consider myself. Of all the martial arts I've learned, my heart and my soul is attached, fully attached to Capoeira. And so I ended up moving out to Colorado and moving through quite a few masters in Colorado. And then our group kind of dissipated, I'd say, about 10 years ago. About 10 years ago, our group split up. And so I've just kind of been a Ronin ever since. I haven't had a Capoeira click in a long time, but I carry it with me wherever I go. But also when I was young, I have an aunt who's an accomplished Wiccan priestess. And she gave me a job one summer working at her bookstore. And that was where I learned about the auric field. Mm. And the effects of stones and crystals, and I think some people call it I forget what it is, the love of stones. Lithophilia.
Okay.
I think that's
it. Brandon.
Lithophilia, the love of stones. Nice.
You have the little peach moonstone skull.
Wow.
With the raven on top. Heart. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, I got a bunch of stones.
Very nice. Yeah. So, yeah, it was at the bookstore that I learned about the aura, and I knew it was true right away. And the book was speaking of it in great detail. And I was just fascinated because it seemed like such a developed concept, but it was not taught to me by anybody. People didn't talk about it, you know. It just seemed like this whole missing field of study in our culture, the unseen realm. That developed greatly in my massage therapy practice. And I've proven it out, tested it 1,000 times through my martial arts and through being a massage therapist as well. So that's kind of part of what makes me who I am and informs my perspective in the world.
I love it. And I do have a question for you, because I remember you and Topher talking about when you massage people, like you can tell their energy, you can feel their energy. And I remember Topher saying something to the effect of, I can tell if they're, I don't remember the words he used. Was it alien, or if they're like foreign or not, like not of this, not necessarily not of this world, but like not human, I suppose, or just like otherworldly. I don't know the words he used, but do you remember him talking about that?
I don't, but I know that he is very experienced, and he has seen
a lot of
what there is to see. Yes, for sure.
Okay, I was going to ask you if you have felt something like that when you massage people. Like, can you tell certain things about them?
Yes. I know when a person is not in their body comfortably.
Okay.
You know, and it's a joy to, you know, when you finish the job, to feel that you've brought them back to their center and help them find themselves. You know, some people need it more than others, I guess, or I guess everybody needs things a little bit differently, but
yeah,
yeah, it just, it feels good when you start out and you're like, oh, there's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And then when you get done saying, I think that helped.
Yeah. I love that. That's awesome. Yeah.
So I'll tell the Gordy story.
Oh, yes. I am excited. Yes.
Before you do that, did you know that, have you ever seen that show Bob's Burgers? Because they do an episode about capybara.
I love
that's
that,
how yeah. I learned about it from, because I used to watch that show. Yeah.
Yes. That guy was hilarious with his long hair flowing.
Yeah. And he's like whipping people with his hair. Yeah. Yeah. I should do that. Braid it up and start whipping people. Anyway, sorry. I just wanted to, if you weren't aware, I wanted you to make sure you were, because it was hilarious.
Oh, whipping yeah. people like Jesus.
And I love they even did, they kind of paralleled it with, Karate Kid, you know, because Karate Kid does the wax on, wax off painting, and then she's in the restaurant, like wiping the tables. She's doing the little moves while she wipes the tables. Oh, it's man. Pretty cute. So a while back, it was about a year ago, I'd say, because it was spring. Gordy and the spiders and I, we kind of planned a time to coordinate a meditation window in different locations. I'm in Indiana, and Gordy is all the way in Arizona.
Where I am.
Yeah, yeah. And so we set a time so that, you know, taking into account the time zones. And it was really fun. I had I had the whole day open. I was able to actually go out in the yard. And I found a spot. I just kind of picked a location. I feel like I might have picked it because there was a nice dandelion patch next to where I wanted to be. And I actually prepared the area with the little capoeira song. And I got out my birimbau instrument, and I kind of walked the circle a few times and created the ceremonial space. And then I literally set the birimbau down in the house, set my phone aside, got my mind clear, and then went and proceeded to, meditate for, I would say, 20 minutes, maybe a little longer than that. And I'm rusty on my meditation, you know, the clouds come and then you got to watch them go. So, you know, out of the 20 minutes, I was probably, you know, nice and centered for 10 of them. And I remember feeling a presence at the end of it that was like distracting. And it wasn't me. It wasn't my thoughts. I couldn't move this presence away. And so I came out of my meditation and look down on the dandelions next to me. There's a little orange summer moth. And it looks a little bit like a monarch, but it's not. It's an orange moth. And he's just kind of dancing around on the dandelion. And I'm like, oh, hey, buddy, glad you came to join me, you know? And I just kind of sat with him and enjoyed his company and realized that I think I'm done. And so I got up and I went into the house, went to the bathroom, come back, and I checked the phone just to maybe see what's going on in Arizona. And I feel like there was a chance that some of the other spiders might have joined us, but I wasn't sure who was, you know, who had made it and who didn't. And when I came back, Gordy had posted a video of an orange summer moth on his hand that would not leave him. And he's sitting there with this thing on his hand, and he's turning his hand over, and this little moth is just crawling and attaching. And I think he even kind of like gives it a chance to leave. He like shakes his hand and it won't go away. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. We had the same spirit animal visit us in the same moment that we're casting the same intention. And I'm like, you know what? I bet I can go back to my little spot in the grass, sit down and call the moth back. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow.
I went back to my little patch of by the dandelion with my phone this time. And I got still once more. And I just waited. And it wasn't a minute before the little moth came back to the dandelion. And I got to snap a picture of it. And then I sent it to Gordy. I was like, we totally linked, bro. We totally linked.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a really remarkable time. And it was an honor because Gordy he's our beast master. You know, Gordy is totally our beast master in the crew. So I feel like I was channeling his energy more than anything, that it was coming through because I was linked to Gordy. So,
oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I love that dude.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, a great guy.
I hope to meet him in person someday at a bear meetup or something.
Yeah. I got my Gordy balls over there. Let me go get them. Bring them close.
Yeah, mine are in the another room. So
I love that picture in the background with that lady shooting that bow and arrow with her feet. That's like,
speaking of that, he has a story about how he kind of did something like that on horseback, and he tells the story on Topher's podcast.
It wasn't on horseback, but
it was like imitation horseback. It was on a trampoline. Now I remember. Thank you. Yeah.
Yes.
Crazy yeah. Stuff.
Yeah, I got into archery when my child was born, back in 2009 or 2010 basically. And life is so miraculous, you know. You make a claim in the world, and it's after the fact that the world proves how magical the idea was. That is a big pattern for me, where, you know, I named my daughter Lyra, and I had no idea when I named her, because it was whatever, five or six months before she came, that I chose the name Lyra. And she kicked when she heard that name, and Mama told me, "Oh yeah, yeah, I think you got it. I think you got the name." And sure enough, she's a Sagittarius, and so Sagittarius is the archer, and and it's also a sage guitarius, because at the beginning of Sagittarius is the Lyra constellation.
What so, the heck?
Yes. So she's,
I was going to ask, where is Lyra?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
She was born essentially on the month. She's on the very cusp of the end of Sagittarius. So Lyra is at the beginning of Sag, and she was born at the end of it.
So she brings it full circle.
Yes, yes. So she is. She's an accomplished archer. She takes after me. She used to sneak out in the yard and take my gear and start pulling shots without me.
Wow.
Which is pretty brave of her. And also, her mother has taught her.
And she's a young teen then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And also her mother has taught her the way of the guitar. So she's pretty decent on a ukulele as well.
Oh, wow.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I got into archery when she was born. I had no idea that would, it was like I was informing myself to be a guide to, you know, fulfill her nature in a strange way. And in that experience, I do all of the bows. People like to know what kind of bow. I have all of them. I've got the recurve. I've got the compound. And my favorite bow of all is my Japanese longbow. And it is a Japanese longbow for a very tall Japanese person. It is, it's like, I think it's a little over 7 feet tall.
Wow.
My longbow is long. And I used it for about a year, But the last shot I will ever take, or at least at this point that I've ever taken with it, I talked about it on the Topher show. I had been practicing archery on a trampoline, and not like it sounds, not to the extent that I'm jumping up in the air and shooting arrows. That's not how it works. I was very simply using the spring to emulate horseback riding. And with my recurve, I was getting very decent at pulling the shot right at the pinnacle of the bounce.
Wow.
And I was getting really decent with my recurve at that. I was hitting the target fairly well. But then I decided to just kind of up the ante and try it with my longbow, which is extra difficult because there's no notch. You're literally shooting off your knuckle with your hand. There's, on your bow arm. And it was my very, I guess I should point this out. I was quite far away from the target. I was, I'd say 40 yards. And I don't think I'm exaggerating. I have a good sense of distance. I was about 40 yards from the target. And that day I had a Arizona iced tea can on a stick was my target. So it was a tiny little thing to be aiming for. And on my first shot with the longbow, I nailed that can.
Wow.
It was amazing. And it was so supernatural that I put it down and walked away. And I feel like I should leave on a win. So yeah, that's my most glorious shot of all time in archery.
And I think you said your daughter was with you.
Yeah, she saw it, but she didn't care. She didn't think it was cool at all. She didn't care at all. She's just like, okay, Dad, get off the trampoline.
My turn.
Yeah. Yeah, she was so not impressed. So typical. So typical.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
So you had sent me some pictures of some things that you might want to share on your screen, and we can talk placenta. We can talk all kinds of stuff. So wherever you want to take this.
Okay. You know,
go ahead.
I remember it was during your guys' show with
Adam.
You guys were talking about the placenta and what he had, his practice with his experience with having his baby come into the world. I am so touched that we have a community that is like really open to talking about this. Yeah. You know, it feels like, setting things right from the jump, you know, the foundation, the first initiation in this world.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it really is. It's going to be a beautiful generation that we're building by expanding this, you know, this consciousness. And one thing I love to point out about the placenta is it's a really great example of how what seems to be scary or frightening or adversarial or even profane is so often actually hiding something deeply profound. And a lot of people get kind of squirmy or uncomfortable or want to look away or change the subject. And I find that that is because we I don't know how else to say it. A lot of people, our culture in general, has an aversion to truth. We don't like to look at our highest possible potential. I think we've been trained and conditioned to look away and change the subject and talk about something else because it makes us
fearful, feel maybe
uneasy. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Of the unknown. Fear of the unknown.
Yep. Exactly. And so the placenta in its own way, it has that effect on people. I watched a short film a long time ago. I think it was called What Babies Want. And it was talking about the birthing process and how for so many generations, we were doing so many things wrong with those first initiatory steps of life. To the extent of, you know, removing the baby and putting it in a separate room where the sounds that they learn to attach to become the beeps and the buzzing of an automated hospital. Beep, 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 bzzz, with the neon lights. And so in the strangest way, their primary imprinting for many generations was the buzz of electricity, as opposed to the mother and the father's voice and the soothing.
Wow.
It is so profound when you think about how tender we are at that age. Everything matters. Everything matters. And as Topher has taught me, the subtle informs the gross.
Yes.
And so I find that there are a great many sacred practices that are still preserved and still observed, that I just think it's just glorious to ponder what a wonderful world it would be if those first steps were a little more sacred and a little more honored, you know?
Yeah. In the podcast we did recently with Grounded Extracts, was that episode 51, Brandon?
Yep.
We talked with Najla, his wife, about her experience. And she talked of, they gave explicit instructions on how they took care of the placenta, because they did a lotus birth where they just let the placenta fall off. And I think it lasted a few days, right, Brandon? Like several days.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that is when they they cleaned it, and then they baked it, and then they encapsulated it. But nice. Yeah, it was very, very enlightening, because I had never really heard anyone tell that great detail about how to care for the placenta in an lotus birth example.
I love that. I love that it's called a lotus birth. It's like the perfect word for it. You know, philologically, the lotus and logos are very closely related for a very good reason.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's funny I said reason, which is logos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My daughter's placenta was, we took it home. It did not stay intact. I did say a lovely prayer that is still one of my most sacred meditations in when I feel the need, and I got to do the cut, which was an honor. And I still have her umbilical cord over there with all my seeds, my seeds for a bright future. But her placenta was, this is kind of funny, it was in the refrigerator. We fully intended to bury it in the yard with the family tree. But then we went through a sudden move. We moved out of the mountains where I had my archery range set up, and we were not fully moved out. We still had a few things in that garage that we were going to come back for. And the placenta was in the freezer in the garage. And then there was a flood, and the flood flooded out all the homes through the valley there. We were in the mountains, and we just couldn't get back because like the roads got washed out. And I'm sure that the placenta was still in the refrigerator, but I like to say that her placenta got washed down the stream and is somewhere in Four Mile Canyon in Boulder, Colorado, you know, under one of those trees randomly, but who knows what really happened. But it is kind of it is appropriate because we were in that same valley when we made her. We were on a it was a date. I think it was an anniversary date when she was fertilized.
Yeah.
And so it's strangely full circle that her placenta had the similar destiny in that location. It's a sacred spot for me. So
it knew where it wanted to go.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So one thing that I've been you know, that I think about with the placenta has a lot to kind of go to bring it back to that aura, you know. I don't know this, but there is, you know, there are a lot of benefits to what they call it placentaphagy. Have you guys heard that term?
I've heard that. I feel like either from you or Chance or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I think
I think that's the scientific term for eating the placenta, for okay. consuming it. And I just think it's such a beautiful potentiality that a person's aura or their glow, I often think of that as our higher self or as our guardian angel, you know?
Yeah.
And I believe in that whole dynamic that is so cartoonish, where, you know, a person has an angel on one shoulder mm-hmm. and a devil on the other shoulder. I think there is something very literal to that possibility, you know, that the placenta would be like the skin outside of our own skin. It's our first layer of skin. And it's also that energy body that gives you, I think, a precognitive sense of things around you, the things you don't know that you know. You know, so many of those aspects of the human experience, I think, are encapsulated in the magic of what our aura is and what it could be if after quite a few generations of what I call instilling the full estate.
And could it be that, you know, the people that know these things, who created all these legal systems to, you know, create a certificate of birth that basically takes charge of that placenta as another dead entity of you that represents you or something like that. Could it be totally. That they knew or they kind of know that, and that's the energy they use to, I guess, to confuse us, perhaps?
I do believe so. And our language actually reveals the truth of this in 1,000 different ways. It's utterly fascinating when you put on the placenta colored goggles and you look at our words, a deep and profound truth is right there in plain sight, you know, like the word big brother. Well, the placenta is a big brother. It is this auric field around you. And it's watching you all the time. It knows what you don't know, you know. There's so much metaphorically hiding within the things, like I said, that seem scary or profane. There's a higher truth being told to you. The twin, it's also your twin is another way to talk about this. It's also your hermano. Is another word for brother. So I think of the Twin Towers, right? Mm-hmm. I think of all these scary Germans, the Germans in the war. That word means brother. Germs right now, everybody's scared of germs. So many of what is used as a boogeyman to psychologically jar us, it hits a chord at the root of the human experience. And so there is a good reason why all things twin, brother, even civil war is brother on brother, brothers fighting brother. You know, all of these are subtle triggers that hit on a deep, deep level for everybody. With, you know, it's the common ground that we all share as beings in the realm. But I wanted to say this. It's going to take me a while, but I'll come back to the topic. But I've learned that at first I heard that there were 5 different words for love in Greek. And I don't have them with me here.
Well, one of them is agape, right?
Yes. Yep. And the different words, there's like, there's love between, there's erotic love, eros.
Okay. Eros, okay.
Eros, there's agape.
There's brotherly love, Philadelphia.
Right.
Something like that. Right?
Yes. And so let me try to think. The word births, affection. The word affection is an English translation of familiar love in Greek. And the word is storge. Storge is the Greek word for familiar love between a brother and a sister, or even your parents. And when we translate it to English, it is the word affection. And so this affection means familiar connectivity, right? And now I'm looking at the word birth, cert, effication, and the affection of your family. Birth is an anagram for tribe. So now I'm looking at birth, sort, your tribe, sort, affection. The sort of tribal affection that you belong to. And so there's something really fascinating hiding inside of just the word birth certification. And I'm getting a lot of reward, not out of only that word, but knowing that birth is an anagram for tribe. It's also tribe is who you travel with, tribulations, who you work with, trabajar, all of these things, your job. Job went through tribulations. He had to travel through a lot of difficulty. So all of these words are deeply connected, and it's just profound that it's all embedded very subtly in the word birth certificate, which, again, when we say, if we say the birth certificate is evil, are we unknowingly saying that my tribe sort of affection is a bad thing? And so there's like an interesting, what seems like evil or malignant might actually be where the answer lies. And so that's the kind of thing I like to do, is like, look at something that is, you know, like I catch myself, I always say like, oh, the elite families, the royal families, the evil elite family. Well, wait a second here. Am I saying that family is evil? Should I be more careful when I vilify other, you know, because everything you say bounces off of me and sticks to you.
Words so true. Don't hurt me.
Yeah. So, yeah, those were kind of some of my discoveries along the way, is like, I'm really getting into this philosophy of, I've been reading Carl Jung for a long time, and really resonating with his work and the fact that we're all in, we all do have a collective experience. We are all connected. Even though I'm not a collectivist, it's hard to deny that we are quite connected.
Yes.
And then I learned that, you know, he had a bit of a phobia, or a field of research that he was afraid of addressing in his lifetime, and that was Friedrich Nietzsche. And he was very cautious about how he approached Friedrich Nietzsche, because he was afraid that he would find himself in Nietzsche's work. And so, you know, after I got a decent grasp on Carl Jung's worldview, I followed in his footsteps, and I've started to look into Friedrich Nietzsche, and I found a lot of rewards. But I'm using a concept that Jung has put into the world. It has his name on it, he proliferated the concept of enantiodromia. And that's such a good word. I just love saying it with a fancy trill.
Is it like Greek? It sounds Greek.
It is, yes.
Okay.
And it means opposites running their course. And I've really gotten a lot of reward out of philosophically embracing the dynamics of looking at opposition, looking at something that is scary or profane or that you have an aversion to, and just locking in, facing it head on, and seeing what truths you're avoiding by doing so. And so Friedrich Nietzsche, coming from a Carl Jung worldview and looking at Friedrich Nietzsche and his philosophy, it's fascinating. And it's already been said. This has already been said, but the longer you stare at the abyss, the longer it stares back at you. And that is kind of what my research has been doing lately, is, you know, looking into that, the void that Friedrich Nietzsche was so fixated on, and finding deep truths that make some people uncomfortable. There's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of value in looking at directly looking at things that make people squirmish.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example of something that you've come to from his work that makes people squirm and that you're okay talking about? Like, I don't want you to feel uncomfortable talking about stuff either.
No. I'm just learning as I go. You know, one thing I have noticed is that Nietzsche would, okay. Well, so one thing I learned that Friedrich Nietzsche was, he is associated with the hammer symbolically.
Sounds like Thor,
doesn't it? Bingo.
We were just talking about Thor with Ben Balderson.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Yes. That's so great that you went there right away. That's great. So at first, you know, I thought, oh yeah, hammers are destructive, but that's not what's going on with Nietzsche.
Build a home with a hammer too.
Build homes. You build new constructs. That's exactly right. And he was a pianist. And the hammer is intrinsic to the piano.
Right. As it hits the string.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes, that is.
And so at first, when I heard that Friedrich Nietzsche philosophizes with a hammer, and this is the general consensus, is, oh yeah, he likes to knock shit down and break it and destroy other people's. No, that's not what's happening. You know, it turns out he is much like our brother Chance with his tuning fork.
Yes.
Nietzsche he'll strike the construct of of previous philosophers, and he'll listen closely to what resonant frequencies are emitted from testing the stability of the worldview of the predecessors who came before him.
Whoa.
And it is a beautiful philosophy. I absolutely love it. What I thought was going to be, you know, violent is actually artistically sophisticated. It's highly sophisticated. So that's one example of like taking something that I thought was going to be dark and evil or bad, or, you know, casting all this judgment on it, and looking at it long enough and giving it the chance to reveal its deeper truth that is not so destructive. And maybe that was my shadow I was projecting when I heard that he, you know, philosophizes with a hammer. So that's one fun example.
Oh, I love it. That was great.
Yeah. He also, you know, he looks into, and some of the philosophers he's testing also have a very negative
bent.
Yes, yes. And even reputation. They have they've acquired a bad reputation over in the collective worldview. And one is like Machiavelli. Nicola Machiavelli, you know, a lot of people think of him as a bad guy, a manipulator, which they're kind of right. but it was for a good reason culturally in his time, in his place, and in the context of his experience, he was manipulating for a very good reason. So, I've been kind of embracing the oppositional energies of history and giving them a chance, and, you know, really testing them out in my own way and discovering so much more than I ever imagined. It's been really rewarding.
I love that. I love that because, like, on our show, we talk a lot about loving others and having compassion on others. And, people don't do it enough, I don't think. You know, there's always rivalries. There's always like pointing the finger. I'm the victim. You're trying to hurt me, et cetera, right? And so Brandon and I always talk about, I mean, we can do the same thing too. Like I can be driving down the road and be annoyed at the person in front of me because they're not moving. I get it. Like, I know how that feels to just be like, move it, people, you know, but we have to learn some compassion toward other people. I think that's what this realm is all about, is to learn love and compassion for others.
That is so true. I love that.
Yeah. Despite how retarded they may act.
Yes. And, you know, bring back the good descriptions of people. Retarded does not get used enough. That is such a good word. Why did
I use it all the time, every day?
It's such a good word. My kiddo, she got really offended because I used the word retarded, and because she's got a lot of the woke programming going on. And so we had a discussion, and I said, no, the word retarded is used for people as a pejorative. Mm-hmm. It is meant to, in its finest minutia of its meaning, it is for, you know, people who are slow, not picking up on what needs to be done. And for people who are mentally handicapped, we don't call them that anymore. We don't call them that. We use special other words for them that are more delicate and more appropriate, because today the word retarded is for retarded people.
Yeah, it's the same like on a car engine. If you're working, or when you used to work on the timing, you would slow it down. They would call it retarding, you know, retarding the timing. Yeah, it's just
slow it down.
That's slow down and thinking.
Yes.
Some retard gave mental handicapped people that label, and now we've been paying for it ever since.
Isn't there a t-shirt, Brandon?
Oh, yeah. Something. Yeah, it's actually, it's a shirt that I sent to Owen, that Ukrainian bear gave to me. And it's it says like 1982 golf classic, something like Swing for the Retards or something. Yeah. So, Owen, I just sent it out yesterday, actually. So, well, in this, he probably already got it by the time this airs. But yeah.
Oh, you know what? I want to go back to the placenta.
Yes. Please.
Okay. This is so fun. So I did not know about the lotus birth yielding the whitening of the umbilicus. I had not heard of that. And when it was on your show, that you guys, what's his name again?
Adam.
Adam.
Plasma Bear. Yeah.
Big love to Adam, man. That was such a touching show. Anybody who hasn't seen that, go back and get it.
Because
I know it's hard to keep up with the embarrassment of riches that our community generates. So if anybody missed that gem, go back and get it. I almost missed it. I remember being excited when I saw it, getting distracted, and I'm so glad you mentioned it so I could go back and watch it. So the whitening of the umbilicus is really profound. For one, it makes me think of the lotus. Lotus flowers are generally white.
Mm.
but there is a long mythology that is in many cultures around the concept of when a miracle happens, a person will turn white.
Or their hair turns white, right?
Or their hair turns white.
Yes. Gandalf, Brandon?
Gandalf.
What? Oh, yeah. Gandalf the white.
The white.
Oh. You've got it. You've got it. Wow. And so I'm not 100%. I looked it up as we were going here. Now, this might not be the actual term for it, but I know there's a scientific name for when a person goes through sometimes a trauma. You know, the cliche is that they see a ghost and they turn white, meaning mm-hmm. like they turn pale because they're, mm-hmm. you know, because their parasympathetic nervous system is kicking in.
Washed out.
Yeah. Yep. But what I've found is poliosis is also called circumscripta.
Ooh.
Isn't that a fascinating term that is just packed with meaning? Circumscripta. It occurs when you have a white streak in your hair, contrary to your natural hair color. This can affect the hair on any part of the body, including your eyebrows and eyelashes, as well as the surrounding skin. So those are just a couple things to look into. Wow. Because they do have scientific precedent. Now, it hits so many chords for me. There are so many mythologies. I used to read fantasy fiction by an author named David Eddings. And he had a character, she was a witch or a sorceress, and she had a white streak in her hair because of one of her initiation experiences where she became, and her name was Polgara. And it's just interesting because this name is, poliosis isn't one of the names for this.
Ooh.
Now,
polio?
No, right? It kind of has that polio in there. Yeah, there's something weird about it.
Mm. And then something sounds like circumcision.
Yes.
The circumcision of the heart that the Bible talks about.
Yes. This is really profound. There's a lot to this. And I'm just kind of coming into this on the fly here. But so I believe it's Moses is in contention with the Lord. And I forget the entire scene, but I do know that the Lord tells him to place his hand inside of his robe. Mm-hmm. And when he pulls it out, it turns white like ash or like a leper.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the Lord tells him to place it back in his robe, and then it is healed and it comes back to normal. And mm-hmm. that is one of like a conversion experience for him.
It was one of the signs that he said to show the people, because I think he was concerned that they weren't going to believe that he was sent by God to take them out of the land of Israel the land of Egypt or whatever. Yes. So he's like, what can I do? And I think that was one of the signs that he gave.
Nice.
Speaking of Tolkien, Saruman, he was the white hand. He branded all his orcs with the white hand stamp.
Oh my gosh. That is so true. That's right. That's right. So it makes me think of all of the Masons with their hand in
hidden
their
hand. The hidden oh hand. My gosh.
Yes. Which was Napoleon. That was Napoleon's signature move. Oh, wow. He had a hand on his nipple line. Okay. Nipple line.
That's hilarious.
Wow.
His nipple line. Right.
I wonder if his name wasn't Napoleon and they gave it to him because of that action.
I wonder about that dude. He is such a construct in a thousand different ways. Like,
oh yeah.
He wasn't really short. He did a identity switch with his brother at the end of his life. So that makes me think that there were many Napoleons in many places, you know. Mm-hmm. I think there were quite, and his name Bonaparte. Well, he was proliferating the advancement of cannon technology. And so everything got blown apart by Bonaparte. You know, it's so wild what is packed into his name. So
wow. Bona is good, part is part. So a good part, I don't know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Or a good parting, maybe. Like I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Say goodbye. Kiss your ass goodbye. We're gonna get blown apart.
By Bonaparte.
Yeah. So this poliosis, it has a lot of other, it was expressed. Okay, well, I want to say this. I think that we might have a little nod and a wink to the Mormon spiritual conversion. Mm. The Mormon, the Book of Mormon used to, I think they've kind of shoved this under...
Grabbed it?
Yeah, yeah. Put this under the rug, so to say, yes. But in its earlier expressions, the Book of Mormon used to claim that people who would read the Book of Mormon and become a convert, when the Spirit would come over them and they were converted to the to their ideology, that they would become white. And the way that it was read in the early days was like, you give the Book of Mormon to an indigenous person, be they black or red-skinned, yellow, whatever, and then they become white-skinned by reading the book. And that doesn't make any sense. Science has clearly kind of debunked the shit out of that. So they've kind of put that aside. They don't really harp on that so much, but I just find it fascinating that it resonates back to the Moses in the changing of his hand to white and the circumscripta.
Yeah, it's very symbolic. So the Mormons created all the white people. Thank you, Mormons. Aha. In Salt Lake City.
Aha. And think of this. Think of how the birth certificate, you're exchanging a red, a dark body. You're exchanging it for a white piece of paper. And so in a crazy way, the birth Mormon certificate is, yes, the birth certificate is circumscripta in a fascinating way. So there is a bit of a conversion there. It's like, I know that the birth certification process, it relates to the Stamp Act and of, I think that's 1812, which later became inscription, but it had another name, where they would capture a vessel, a trading vessel, and pick out the most able-bodied men off the ship, and saying, "You're now inscripted. You're coming with us." And they would convert them to laborers for the army.
Conscription, and maybe?
I think it's conscription. Yes. And so there's a history of doing this where you're like, doesn't matter what you want. You're on our team now. And so I think of the Stamp Act as like the baby's feet, that they're stamping the baby's feet on the certificates, you know? Yeah. It's so fascinating how, the process has had more nefarious incarnations in the past, and now we've smoothed it out and people have come to terms and just accepted and gone along to get along, you know, because they couldn't look the darkness in the face long enough. They had to get all uncomfortable and just ignore the elephant in the room.
Wow.
So and then that also was in the Ghostbusters, like you were saying, where the two women
me that clip of Ghostbusters Save New York, I think is the version. Newest one, where the ladies are the Ghostbusters, and then I guess two of them get two of them fall into a portal, kill the beast or whatever, and then get pulled out of the portal, and then when they get pulled out of the portal, their hair is white.
And they have an umbilical cord. The second sister, she keeps a cord attached to her and goes diving in.
Yeah.
To save the other one. And it's because of that string that they get saved.
You're right. Yes.
Okay. And then when they get saved, this is the salvation. This is the placenta saving the placenta, keeping it. Right.
Oh, wow.
And when they come out, they both have white hair.
Wow. I think that's in another movie, too, where they go through a different dimension, but they tie a rope on them. Was it Poltergeist maybe or something?
Oh, wow.
I can't remember, but they pull them out and the rope's all gross or whatever.
Oh,
interesting. That is interesting.
I have to do some looking into that.
I never saw that movie. Don't want to.
Yeah. It's probably really cheesy these days, but it was scary when I was a child.
Yeah.
So now, with this in mind, with this signature of, you know, mythological enchantment, and it is cross-cultural. It's not just, you know, it's not, I'm not pigeonholing any particular interest group, but I will point out that Tulsi Gabbard. Are you guys familiar with Tulsi Gabbard?
Name is familiar, but I don't know why.
The politician, she's from Hawaii, and she was one of the presidential candidates. She was going to run for president in the primaries in the last election. And she has been on my radar pretty powerfully because when she stepped onto the world stage, she has a very fascinating career. Like I said, she's from Hawaii. She is, I think she's considered Samoan. Her family has very religious affiliations, very interesting religious affiliations. But what gets me is as she came onto the stage, they started to reboot Wonder Woman. And the entire story arc of Wonder Woman goes in stride with Tulsi Gabbard's career. And she is a one-to-one match. She is absolutely an amazing embodiment of the Wonder Woman character. And so I see her as not only an incarnation of Wonder Woman, even earlier, the origin of Wonder Woman goes back to Athena, the goddess Athena. And Athena was born fully armored. She came out of Zeus's head because he ate her mom, Metis. In fear that the brother would replace him. So he convinced Metis to do a magic trick and become a fly. And then he eats her and he becomes impregnated and he gets a splitting headache. This is literally where the word splitting headache comes from. And Hephaestus cracks his head open and Athena is born out. And she's born fully armored. She has the full armor of God instilled into her persona. And she is gray-eyed Athena. And I believe there is powerful placenta metaphor in play in this mythology. And today's modern incarnation of this myth is alive, thriving, and probably going to take the throne in the next election, I think. I think we should all be watching Tulsi Gabbard in a because there's just a fascinating light around the arc of the construct that is named Tulsi Gabbard, whatever that real person is all about. She has a white streak in her hair. And so she is going to be playing a savior role with the Great Reset rolling out going forward.
Wow.
So I think we have a real strong fit for what I think will be an inevitable, whether it's 4 years from now, or I guess it would be 6 years from now, or if she's the next one to take the throne. I'm predicting Tulsi Gabbard is definitely lined up for some magical savior role on the horizon.
The lady in the X-Men, I forget her name, but one of them, she has that white streak too.
Oh, is that Storm?
Yeah, Storm.
Nice. Nice.
I used to know a woman who had a white streak in her hair, and I was like, you look like Storm.
Doesn't Morticia Adams also?
Oh, yeah.
I think so.
Is it two? One or two?
I think two, yeah.
And like the show Wednesday was recently rebooted and everything.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, there's a new show called Wednesday.
And it's Wednesday today as we record.
Yeah. Odin's Day.
Yeah.
Odin's Day. Yes.
And we recorded with Odin's Alchemy yesterday.
Hell. That's awesome. Big love, Ben Balderson.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a legend. Wow. But, go ahead.
Yeah, really, really cool stuff. I had sent you a video about dolphin assisted birth. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely.
And, you know, that happened in Hawaii. I wonder if Tulsi Gabbard was born by dolphins, like, or with the dolphin assisted. Yeah, he's like, we're on the same page. Yeah. Because when you said Hawaii, she was from Hawaii, I was like, oh, because I forgot that. I knew who she is. I know who she is. But yeah, I was like, I wonder if she's dolphin born. And then Sharon brings it up.
Yeah, interesting.
It would be so fascinating if she was. Yeah, so that video was kind of worldview altering for me. Because I love the idea of, you know, nature. The dolphins responding to a pregnant mother and, you know, circling around and giving her, you know, therapeutic attention and, you know, literal vibrations to intensify the magic of the birthing. That's so priceless.
And they speak with like the sonar type stuff, right? And babies inside, you know, and probably can hear the sonar too, because they're in water as well, right?
That's yes.
And for people who don't know, referencing, there was a place in Hawaii where you used to be able to give birth among dolphins. It was like a sectioned off part of the beach or some kind of cove, like, or whatever.
Sanctuary.
They had sanctuary. They had dolphins in there and mothers would give birth among the dolphins. But for some reason, it got shut down recently
for
or whatever.
Some reason. Yeah. So, how we allow these authorities to tell us what we can do is just mind boggling to me.
Yes.
It's kind of amazing when you think about it. I was saying this on the show with Ben Balderson, but the way that the control system is set up, you know, I'm kind of in awe of it. Again, I don't support it or whatever, but I try not to give it my hatred, you know, because we see these people, most of them making choices to remain in the system. And people like us have, once you're aware of it, and then that's really your point to make the choice. You know, it's like Neo, you could take the red pill or the blue pill. You know, do you want to wake up or do you want to go back to sleep? So.
Yes.
But anyway, go ahead, Gabe.
Well, there's a few things that rhyme with the dolphin assisted birthing. And I guess I'll there's a book out there called Creating Christ, and I forget the author's name, but he has a fascinating field of study that is essentially focusing on the heraldry of the, I believe it's the Flavian family, the bloodline of the Flavians back in Rome, that the Flavians had a family crest that was oftentimes like a Jesus figure on an anchor. And they would also have dolphins swimming around them. And so some of these family names, I believe it's the Tacitus Flavius, might be who the historical persona is at the root of this heraldry that we still see today. We will often see family crests with a dolphin in embedded into the imagery of their family crest. So that is likely a thread through the bloodlines going back to this Tacitus Flavius family that had a claim that they were of the bloodline of Christ. And that's fascinating because we know that the Jesus fish, the ichthus, is the sign of Jesus. So that's a thread that is just something to consider, that there are people who still give a lot of value to the family lines and the family crests and the symbolic language of all of that in the royal circles, we'll say. That comes to mind. But something else is on my mind, and it might be related. I'm not sure if it is, but the Merovingians, they have a fascinating mythology about their matriarch, that she, and this is going back to like this is like the Franco-German Empire before the Anglo-Saxons, before the Romans invaded. This is like when France and Germany were still considered one and the same.
Germania, I think it was, or whatever.
Maybe.
Ben Balderson was talking about it on last week's show.
Yes, yes. Nice. Mm-hmm. Yes. So there was a time when France and Germany were essentially under the same kingship, we could say, and that they were claiming, the Merovingians in particular, in those days, they were claiming that their matriarch had been left alone down by the ocean, and that she was impregnated by a god of the sea, you could say. There's many ways to say this. I'm being very tactful. Some people some people will tell the story as she was raped by a sea monster is another way that the story comes out. But I'd like to kind of maybe tell both sides of what was possible here. So being impregnated, being impregnated by a god of the ocean, or if you want to be all vulgar, I guess it keeps the story alive longer. It gets past, it has, if it's scary, if it has something traumatic attached to it.
Yeah. So
maybe drama. That's why, maybe that's why it gets packaged that way. But mm-hmm. So their claim was that their matriarchal line essentially would have, we could say, a sanguinity to Neptune, to the god Poseidon. And they were claiming that their divine right to rule in the kingship of their day and in their arc of reign actually goes back to the ocean, has oceanic origins.
Holy smokes.
And that is something that the Merovingians are very, that's a line in the sand that they draw. When you research the Merovingians, they will say, we were not from the bloodline of Zeus. We were not Jovian. We are not from this rapist god who flies around and rapes people from the skies. Our divinity comes from the waters. And so that's just something else I would kind of interject into this idea of dolphin births. Maybe Tulsi Gabbard is from Hawaii, an aquatic oriented location. And, you know, if she is claiming to be any kind of savior coming forward, maybe she has a little tie-in, a little thread going back to the Merovingians, we'll say.
Wow. And that's also kind of funny with the dolphin correlation, because I know that dolphins are one of the only animals that will actually rape. Well, I guess ducks rape, but dolphins are, as far as mammals or whatever. Yeah, it's crazy. Or they're known for it anyway. Maybe they're not the only ones. Oh, no, I think they're one of the only species besides humans that have sex for pleasure. But then they also will.
That's what I've heard.
And they also will rape. Damn raping dolphins.
So I have a project that I talk about a lot. It's not... it's only a couple installations on my Slick Dissident Shared Learning Experience channel. But I call it the Territories Map. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen, I mean, I have so many random videos on my channel. It's so hard to give anybody any guidance. And I name all of my videos have names I'll never remember. So it's like, it's really hard to try to steer people towards my work.
Maybe making playlists. Like once, like when you first put a video out and then it's like in a certain realm of thought, add it to a playlist that is part of that concept or thought process.
I just wrote it down. It's 80% more likely to manifest now. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's, no problem. That's
great advice. I am totally going to do that. So my territories, it's pretty easy to explain verbally. I've essentially put superimposed a zodiac onto the map of the United States. I've also done this on the world map. And with the United States in particular, this gives me a really fascinating lens into a lot of what is conveyed to us through the headlines of the news. I see many things through this little matrix that I've made, but the Mason-Dixon line is the 37-degree parallel. And if you're looking at the map, that Mason-Dixon line is it's actually the state border between, like, I believe it's Tennessee and Kentucky. There is a line, and it's almost an eye line going most of the way through the U.S. But 37 is a very special number in many ways. If you continue across the ocean, it also divides, it goes right through the Strait of Gibraltar, which gives you access to the Mediterranean Sea. So that line is a defining line of actual geomantic features across the map, we'll say. So yeah, 37 degrees, that is my equinox line. And then I use the Mississippi as my solstice line. So you're getting the X and the Y axis of the United States by using the 37-degree parallel in the Mississippi. And then I put a zodiac down. And it sounds random at first. However, not only do the 12 stations of the zodiac have conformity to many of the signs, symbols, icons, state logos, football team mascots, but when I put the tarot cards of the major arcana onto the zodiac, then even more of the state mascots and logos and the state crest and the state flags, they all, not all, that's hyperbolic.
Many of them
conform to this little vision that I call the territory system. So I will oftentimes hear of a headline or a location in the United States, and I will just stay, because I have it memorized in my mind. But I'll just say often, in my territories map, that is in the location of, and so this is fun because Hawaii is really gratifying. It's in Pisces. And I give it, yes, and I give it the moon card in the tarot. And this is really interesting, particularly with the Crowley deck, the Thoth deck. That moon card has a lot of volcanic imagery.
Wow.
Conveyed through the symbols, symbolically, on the moon card. And so having Tulsi Gabbard come from Hawaii, which conforms to the Piscean symbology, and that moon card in particular, is really, I don't know, just gives me a bit of a magical sense that she has quite a profound destiny going forward.
I'm going to share that right now because I brought up a picture of the moon card. So let's see.
Good.
So yeah, we can kind of take a look at it. There it is.
Wow.
So you can see a magma chamber in the bottom.
Magma. With the scarab beetle surrounding the core of whatever that is.
Yes.
And the lobster's in like the Rider-Waite, right? Is it a lobster or a crab?
Lobster, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
And even those waves are, you know, like they're sine waves. Mm-hmm. But they could be like, you know, volcanic seismic signatures, so to say.
Could be water as well, water waves. Right.
Big time, yeah. And Hawaii is very topographically extreme. They have a lot of mountains. Yes.
Waterfalls.
Yeah. There's also, there's a few lighthouses. And so these two towers here are, to me, very clearly lighthouses, don't you think?
They do look like it.
Yeah.
They look exactly like lighthouses. Wow.
Right.
And you get the ads above, so below thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So there is so many fascinating things about Hawaii, so many fascinating things. But I will say this, that I believe, so I've read Moses and Monotheism by Freud, Sigmund Freud. His name is like Sign World Freud, Sigmund. It's like the world of signs.
Yes.
And he wrote quite thoroughly on symbolism. Yeah, that was his jam, you know.
Wow.
In his book, Moses and Monotheism, he makes a claim that got him a lot of flack. It was a controversial claim in his day. But he makes a claim that that Yahweh was a volcano god.
I'm not surprised.
Yes.
I've heard it referred to as Shiva as well.
Right. Right. It's a really gratifying possibility to, you know, to hold a potential for. And this really gets hits the mark with Hawaii, because when you say Hawaii in reverse, it is Yahweh.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Hawaii, Yahweh.
Smokes.
Basically saying the name of the god of the ancient Israelites. I want to be specific here. The ancient Israelites, going back to a time and a place that we probably wouldn't recognize in our modern day sensibilities. But yeah, that really hits a chord. The fact that all of Hawaii is a volcano.
Yeah, and you know? It seems that it looks like there's evidence that people claim or whatever, but that the Pacific Ocean used to be a lot lower. And now you say they're mountains. Maybe they were just mountain tops at the time, and then they just became islands.
Nice. Nice. Yes. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many mysteries. I mean, we are literally just scratching the surface, but another one I like to just kind of hint at, and it will circle back to that, the ashen hand, or the hand that was like ash or like leprosy. There is a leper colony on Hawaii that is very sacred, that has a very fascinating history. And that leper colony is the, okay, let me say this. I have always held space for this idea that if you had a sacred artifact, if you wanted to hide something, that it should never be tampered with, and nobody would even consider messing around with whatever you're trying to preserve.
You hide it in plain sight?
The best place to hide it would be a leper colony. Because
no one wants to go there.
Nobody wants to go there. Nobody even wants
except
to go
Jesus.
With, yeah, except for a healer, a person with enough compassion to approach such a scary situation. And I've thought that for a very long time, and that was long before I learned that there is a sacred leper colony on the island of Hawaii. They've been moved around and politicized, and they have a sordid past. But it turns out they speak a very unique language.
What?
And I'm beginning to believe that the artifact that is preserved
is the language itself.
Is the language itself.
Wow.
Insane.
That made me think of a leprechaun, right? And a leprechaun at the end of the rainbow is their pot of gold.
Oh, shit.
Yes. Yeah.
And putting it together.
A leper colony on, it reminded me of the white streak, like a leper colony in the middle of whatever. It's like a white streak in the middle of just normal stuff.
Yes. So I mean, we could leave it right there, but I believe there is a mystery of mysteries hiding inside of the general framework of what we've laid out here. I think there is something very sacred and very special going on in Hawaii. And I don't know what it is, but I do know that a lot of precious mythology is keeping alive like a roadmap, the possibility of, you know, some very enchanted souls in this world that should be, you know, preserved and respected and honored. And something about Tulsi Gabbard, I see a fascinating future ahead of her. And I don't really know what I'm looking at, but it is mystically supercharged. I'll just leave it at that. And it would be so cool to find out she was dolphin birthed. That would be so cool.
I wonder if we could somehow find out. I know Wikipedia wouldn't tell us for sure.
Yeah, we keep idea away.
So, do you feel like you're wrapping up what your discussion is? Was there anything else you wanted to talk about? I know we talked a little bit about the Enneagram and the life path number before we came on. So if you want to talk about that, we can.
Yes. Well, I guess I'll just kind of hint towards where my work is right now. I discovered something really fascinating. Again, you know, I get these sneaking suspicions, and I've even made claims early in my work where I'm like, you know, the Enneagram is ancient. It's been around for way longer than they're telling us. But then it takes me a while to actually do the legwork to substantiate that idea and that claim. And I'm pretty excited because I think I have found the Enneagram immortalized in Plato's Republic. Mm. And that's pretty freaking old. and it's been there all along. It is particularly preserved in the book known as Plato's Symposium, which is a fictional account of a group of philosophers sitting around in a circle and discussing their opinions on what love is. And this is really neat because, you know, originally I learned that there were 5 words for love. And then I found out there were 7 words for love in Greece. So it's just kind of interesting that each one of them is taking, you know, a different angle and discussing what love is. And so I believe if you take love and you make it a spirit, a presence in the room, and then you put it in the position of the number 6 on the Enneagram, which is sometimes called the loyalist.
The lover's card.
It's the lover's card, card number 6. You got it. So this is what I've done. I've taken the tarot and I've used the tarot and I've personified it through the Enneagram. And then I'm finding out that the personalities sitting around in the circle of the symposium are actually eulogized or immortalized in the card itself. And so now I'm literally using the tarot deck to paint the picture of this setting, of this conversation, of these Plato's symposium and these philosophers. And it is so rewarding. It is so rewarding, this little project I've got going. And so, yes, you're totally right. You got it. The lover's card is it is the spirit of what they are discussing. And so it's not a person in the room, but it is a space holder in the 6th position. And so they all are talking around love in their own little way. And at the end of the conversation, Socrates, he's the number seven. He's like the Cancer, the Chariot card. He's
a Cancer.
Oh, nice. Nice. So he's sprawled out on the couch. He's taking up the most room. And in the Enneagram, a number seven is a enthusiast with a shadow of glutton. And that's kind of interesting because Socrates can drink and drink and drink, and he never gets drunk. He also asks questions forever and ever and ever, and he never gets satisfied. That's all he does is take in, take in, take in, take in. So he's an epicure. He's also with the shadow of glutton. He's a perfect incarnation of the chariot card sprawled out, taking up all the room on the bench. So the suspense builds with every character as they go around the symposium, and everybody knows that Socrates is the smartest man in the room. So they save him for last because they know he's going to trump everybody no matter what. And sure enough, he knocks it out of the park. The crowd's going wild. Everybody's clapping, and they're all, you know, golf clap, golf clap. And while they think that they've solved love and this is the end all be all of love, the doors crash open and Alcibiades comes storming into the room. He's being carried by by a flutist and by the populace. He's being carried because he's drunk. And so this is the number eight position. This is the challenger with a shadow of lust. And he comes into the room and he is literally tracing the heptad of the Enneagram, the sixth stationed little spider in the center. He's literally blocking, as if this was a play, he's literally walking on the line from the eight down to the five. And he goes up to Agathon and he gives Agathon a reef as a gift because Agathon's the host of the party. And then he takes the seat of the six. He takes the position of the lover's card and he starts professing his love to Agathon, but he's also trying to angle in on Socrates. And he's basically trying to play his odds on both sides. He's like, if I can't get with Alcibiades, maybe Socrates will take me. And he's like trying to wedge his way in between them. And then you find out that Socrates is actually in love with Agathon. It's all super gay. It's super duper gay. but what is fascinating is that essentially what I've discovered is that the Enneagram is that old. And that I believe the priest class, who we call the Actors Guild, they've been using this personality matrix for a very long time. And it's worth my while to see past all the homoerotica to actually, you know, discern and pull the gems out of what seems to have been a very gay endeavor in its time. But again, it's fascinating because there are seven different forms of love. And in this process, many of those different fractal ways, like a diamond, it's like looking through a prism and seeing all the full spectrum of the experience of love. It's really fascinating. So that's where my project went recently. I found the Enneagram quite alive in Plato's Symposium. And then now I'm going through John Milton's Paradise Lost. And he has the story of the fallen angels. And I'm quite sure that he was also embodying the Enneagram, but in a different way, almost as though he were trying to break up the gay sex party of the Greeks. to break it up and disseminate it into its different constituent parts. And so, yeah, I'm essentially looking at the pandemonium, which is the house of all demons, as like a Christianized chastising of the Greeks for being so homoerotic. And then that book, Paradise Lost, is a poem, and it was launched right after the London fires, right after 1666. It came onto the human consciousness the year after the prize law of birth certification was initiated. It's a crucial time in history. And so, yeah, I'm looking at the Paradise Lost and Pandemonium, the House of All Demons, and the idea of Satan going into the garden to tempt Eve. And it is actually what I'm finding is that it's all a profound cosmodrama. You know, these are
right, like astrotheology metaphor, right? That's what I was thinking.
You got it. You got it, sisters. That's what's up. That's totally what's up. So, yeah, I can actually track the story through the stars in a really interesting way. But what this does is instead of a 12 station zodiac, it's given me a glimpse at what might have once been, what's called the Roman Fasti calendar. It was a 9 station zodiac. And so instead of 30 day long months, they had 40 day long months. And it was a whole different construct of time. And so that's kind of what I'm seeing is that if you look at the stories and the way they were told, you can actually potentially, my goal is to hopefully get a map of the sky from the old construct of time where there were 9 months instead of 12.
Does the, and wow, that's amazing. Does the Enneagram go to 9?
1 through 9.
Okay.
In the Greeks forbid 0.
Okay.
It was not allowed. That's why, you know, they use an X as their symbol for number 10, and there's no zeros. And then the whole Roman numeral system is totally different from what we use today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it becomes really interesting to go into a different form of thinking where the zero was not allowed. However, they are, 1 through 9 is in a ring. It is sitting inside of a circular construct. So the spirit of the void is present in
circular.
In the stagecraft, if you will.
That's insane.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No.
I was going to say, I'm wondering what Brandon's Enneagram is. Well, do you remember what yours is, Brandon?
How do you find that out?
Oh, Lord, never mind.
No, I'm just wondering because I might know, but I'm just.
I went to a website called truity.com.
Oh, okay. I think I've looked into it in the past, but it's just been so much data intake. I think I kind of forgot, but I'm going to look into it now, though, for sure.
Yeah, I did mine a while ago and I wrote it down and took notes. But yeah, mine was mostly an 8.
Busting into that party.
Strength card.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Yeah, I'm quite sure that the the string pullers, if you will, that they know our Enneagram score on a really sophisticated level. And that is how they market to us. Mm. You know? So I think if they're going to presume to have gait recognition and have any predictive command over our decision making, it's probably worthwhile to find out your own score and your own tendencies and kind of see yourself in the way that the marketing executives like to see you. So then you can be like, you guys have seen Anywhere, Everything, All at Once? Mm-mm. It's a film about a multiverse, a theoretical multiverse, but the way to gain special abilities with your parallel reality self, the way to do it is to do something unexpected.
I was just going to go there. I was just going to talk about I know people dislike Archaics, Jason of Archaics, very much, but Brandon and I got into his stuff before all this, whatever people were talking about him came out, and we just look at people and we just take the information they present and we look into it because it's interesting to us. So anyway, he talks about this concept of like you like being an errant and not doing exactly what is expected of you or what like doing the same thing every day, you know, rat race or whatever, right? You're not following the same path that everyone else is. You're doing something different. And because of that, you're not caught by the trap or whatever it is, you're outside of that. So they can't like get you because you just don't participate in the other things that the hive mind participates in.
And that's awesome.
And you do different things. Like, you know, if you take a walk every day, you take a different route every time. Maybe you move around, you do something different. You don't always do the same exact thing. You don't do the same exact thing every single day at a certain hour on a certain time, you know. You just do different things. And because of that, you're kind of saved from this whole, I guess, trap or marketing to you or whatever it is they try to do.
I love that. That's good advice.
Yeah. Maybe Brandon can say it better than I did, but.
No, you said it about right. He just talks about breaking pattern, you know. So if you have patterns, just do something different one day. Just break the pattern. Don't try to stay in patterns that are easily recognized. And that's funny because that's what they taught us that in the Marine Corps. They would always tell us about not falling into patterns and like walking the same way to work or doing. They're like always telling us to do something different because this way you're not easily a target for an enemy, you know. But it's the same kind of idea though, right? I mean, so I always like to do that, go a different way somewhere, you know, just stop somewhere where I wouldn't. Or, you know, like the other day, actually, it was hilarious when Sharon and I went hiking because she came to New Jersey to visit the love of her life. And while she was there, she went hiking with a bunch of us in Connecticut, and we went into the store. And at the end of, you know, when you ring up, they say, do you want to donate, you know, do you want to round up and donate to charity? And I always say no, because I always think it's a scam. But something last minute was like, sure, I'll round up. And I just did it. And yeah, it was kind of along that same idea. I just kind of want to break patterns and do something different. You know, like I have no idea what that charity is, but it was like a small farmers market is kind of place. So maybe it was something local. I'm like, sure, you can have my 60 cents or whatever it is, you know?
Uh-huh. I love that. Yeah, that's really good advice. That's very sound. You know, I've done that as well. With self-defense, that's a thing that we tell people. You can even take a route that you wouldn't take that isn't even going where you're planning to go, and then dead end, turn around and come back. You know, it doesn't even have to be a loop. You can literally like retrace your steps backwards. And that's a method to like, if you think somebody's following you, well, now they got it. Now they become the prey, so to say.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I would do that a lot because I DJed probably for about 7 years at the same place. It was like this pretty big restaurant that at night they'd clear out the tables and be like a dance club or whatever, and it wasn't very far from my house. And sometimes when I drive home, if I thought somebody's either following me or behind me, I would just keep going past my house and turn around and go a different way, you know, because you never know. You know, I don't want to have to hurt somebody because they think they're gonna rob me, you know.
Something else that's related to that made me think of is I used to have this massage therapist years ago, and I wish he was still around because he was like he was the one who taught me a bunch of stuff about, like, I would say Reiki, even though he didn't really call it that, but maybe he did and I don't remember. But he was just a really great massage therapist. But that kind of ties back to you being a massage therapist. I forgot. But anyway, he always would tell me, like, your body likes novel things. Like, don't always do the same exercise all the time, every day or every, like, do different things with your body. Like, yes. Break the pattern, you know, because your body gets used to the same things over and over. So it's the novel things, the new things that help your body learn something new. And your body likes that. It likes those new things. So it just reminded me of that.
You know, this is kind of fun. So I used to have knee issues. And then I got a job as a furniture mover. And I had to develop the ability to carry weight and walk backwards. And so I became really good at seeing behind myself. Seeing what's behind me without, you know, without literally
eyes behind your head.
Eyes behind my head. I have like really good feelers back there. But then also going up and down stairs.
Backwards too.
Backwards is really good. And now the inadvertent benefit, I did not expect this. It just was a side effect, was that my knees became so much stronger. Mm-hmm. And I regained a stability that I lacked. But also, like you were saying, like putting yourself in a uncomfortable, awkward situation, it just stimulates the mind in a new way. And then this is part of why, I have an eye for anagrams and words in reverse. You know, I often find myself thinking backwards, forwards, and inside out, you know. Wow. And so, yeah, that strangely enough, the way that I've moved my body has also changed the way that I think in a kind of fun way, I think.
Yeah. That's really awesome. Brandon, you're muted.
I used to take showers in the dark sometimes, just in total like darkness, just to, you know, kind of try something different, I guess. You know, I don't know why I did it, but I just felt like I was called to. But it was a really interesting experience. Not that I suggest it for people, because if you fall in the shower, but if you think you can handle it, I just would mostly keep my eyes closed the whole time. I've always been pretty good in the dark, though. So
nice. That's a good one.
I like balancing that walking backwards.
Yeah. I was going to say like balancing, like doing a yoga pose and then closing your eyes, like tree, you know, just do tree and then close your eyes and see if you can stay, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, I like
without
that.
Falling over.
Maybe we could podcast with our eyes closed. Yeah, so you can go to morelawsmoreproblems.com. I'm doing this commercial with my eyes closed. If you want more of the Oversharing Show, click on the Oversharing tab. And why don't you tell people where they could find you, Gabe?
Oh, absolutely. So my YouTube channel, which it's called Slick Dissident is the title, and I refer to it as a shared learning experience. And I always want to make sure that nobody trusts a single word I say. Prove my words on your own. I am an authority on very little in this world. And I make mistakes pretty regularly. Like last night I had to make two videos cause I misspoke on the first one. And yeah, so, there's a lot of just interesting, mental experiments, we'll say, you know, I learned recently that, Lady Frieda Harris, who is the artist who generated the Thoth Crowley tarot deck, she is actually quoted as saying that the deck was contrary to popular belief, she says. It was not meant for divinatory purposes, and that it was a educational tool that would be unpacked over the course of a century. And I find that really a fascinating claim.
Smokes.
Because she was born in 1877. And so in 1977, Star Wars was made. And I have found so many elements of her tarot deck in the Star Wars series and the Star Wars story arc. Yes.
Crazy.
And so, so I'm really focusing on her deck in particular, not as a divinatory tool, although it serves that quite well. And symbolically, it's given me a really deep grasp for the stars, the dynamics of the sky clock. But I've also come to believe, yes, that she's...
this was the bottom card.
Whoa.
Wow.
What the heck? Yo.
Oh, and you got the tower behind that. I know that one.
Powerful reflection. That's cool.
What the heck?
That's cool.
Insane.
Yes.
Wow.
Sorry, it's blurry.
So I'm now beginning to find that she was also, I think, immortalizing the culture creators of her time. And so I have found certain characters, I believe I've found certain characters immortalized in the cards in really fun and fascinating ways. So that's something that I'm doing, is kind of digging out these cornerstones of culture from history through her eyes, and also, you know, probably the eyes of the person who commissioned the deck, he who shall not be named, the old
Aleister Crowley.
Have you ever looked in Michael Tessarion's work about okay.
Well, not on Crowley, but yeah. I love Tessarion.
Yeah, he dives deep in with that deck and with Crowley, so that might be an interesting place for you to look into.
I'm writing it down. That's awesome. Thank you for that. I will. I love Tessarion's work.
Yeah, he has a series called Path of the Fool, where he basically does like an hours long video on each major arcana. Sometimes they'll put them together and talk about them or whatever, but I think you have to be a paid member of his site, but it's totally worth it. I mean, it's good stuff.
Excellent. Excellent.
And he uses the Crowley and the Rider-Waite also, but he focuses a lot on the Crowley deck. So,
yeah, it's good to do both. It's good to see like the fundamentals and the more advanced science that's going on. So a couple more names I need to drop. Definitely. Innerverse with Chance Garton. I'm on there with him pretty much every Wednesday. He's so gracious to let me come on and share my brain babies on a regular basis.
Vibrant.
Yeah, the Vibrant. And then I get down with the Weaving Spider's Webs on Saturdays. That's a spot that there's hours and hours. We weave all from Saturday into Sunday. And then I'm on One podcast and also Rising from the Ashes quite a bit. So those are some of the haunts that I like to float around.
Amazing. And I know our guest from last week, Benjamin Balderson, also after we got done recording, he said he forgot to shout out the spider. So Ben is also on the Weaving Spider. So you can find him there too, everybody. We just fixed that for him.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been great, guys. I love the synchronicities that come up on your guys' show all the time. It's so amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for watching our show also and now being a guest. I think it was a really great episode. A lot of stuff to chew on. I'm excited.
Yeah, you know, I can speak for the spiders. We should have both of you guys back on. I know you were on with us already, Sharon, but Brandon, it's your turn now.
Yeah, I need to. Brandon. Maybe this Saturday, because most Saturdays I'm working, but I have a couple Saturdays off. I'm off this Saturday, so maybe I could figure it out.
Hey, all right. I always tell people, you know, take a nap and pack your homunculus lunch. Because it's a long format.
Will do. Sounds fun.
Nice.
All right. Well, I already gave our commercial. Oh, shout out to the chat. Thank you guys in the chat every Thursday night when we premiere this. At 8:33 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, there's a really fun chat. Sometimes it's just me and Sharon. No, actually, we've been having some really good chats lately. But yeah, so come and join us and hang out. I've seen Slick Dissett in there many of times, so you can always find him in there as well. It's another place to find him. And if you just like listening to audio, we are on Telegram and we're also on Podbean and several other platforms through Podbean. So check it out there over Sharon. And on YouTube, it's just the Brandon and Bonanza channel, and that's where you could find it. And I think that's it. Well, what do we say to the good people, Sharon?
That once you start over Sharon,
then you totally stop being a Karen.
You got it.
I got it this time. That's right. See you guys later. Take care. Bye.
Peace, everybody.